complaints about how my picky eating is childish and prevents him from enjoying certain cuisines. I've also gotten tired of being interrogated each time I express hesitation toward a particular food. He won't accept answers like, I just don't like it. He demands details. Here's a typical conversation we have at a restaurant. I'll take the house salad, but no cucumbers or tomatoes.
What about cucumbers taste bad?
The cucumber part.
But what exactly tastes bad about the cucumber part?
The cucumber taste part.
And what about tomatoes? What's wrong with tomatoes?
The texture. It has the mouthfeel of a poisoned fruit, like something you shouldn't eat.
Well, you still should have ordered cucumbers and tomatoes. I could put them on my salad.
Well, why don't you just ask for extra cucumbers and tomatoes?
Because I don't want them that much. I'm just willing to eat extra if the opportunity presents itself.
As you can imagine, this gets old, and Rhett has slowly worn my food restrictions down over time. But the main reason I've changed my approach to food is that the mythical beasts get some sick joy from watching me try to consume unconventional foods, even though it usually involves me repeatedly spewing these foods into a bucket. I can't say that I enjoy consuming nasty delicacies. It doesn't help that they are often just boiled for safety and not seasoned. But I also can't deny that my desire to give the people what they want on GMM has helped me evolve as an eater. I am much more willing to try different foods than my normal, not doing it for the camera life. Fact is, once you've eaten pig anus, cucumbers and tomatoes don't seem that scary anymore. I've even gotten to a place where I can occasionally get something down that Rhett spits into his bucket.
Bringing a sense of adventure to your meals and taking the risk of overcoming your food fears is an important step in leading a mythical life. You don't have to go as far as we have in your food conquest. We're thinking more about the food you hate because you had one bad experience with it in kindergarten. Or maybe you've never tried it at all. We recently had dinner with an adult male friend who had never tried shrimp. What? How does that happen? There are so many shrimp out there, either swimming in the ocean, spilling out of buffets, or sitting on random trays brought around at parties. You would think that most people would end up getting shrimp in their mouths accidentally. But no, he had never tried it. Until he did. And he liked it. It's kind of like crab, he said.
Aside from helping you discover that you actually might love a food you've been afraid of, there are tons of other reasons why you should take the mythical step of expanding your meal rotation to include more than Cheerios, PB&J, and chicken fingers, in addition to the fact that repeating those three meals exclusively will likely give you late-onset diabetes, which could make you go blind and lose your feet.
Being the person who ate something makes you inherently more interesting than the person who turned something down. Declining to eat something doesn't make a memory. It doesn't create a story. When we are sitting side by side on the porch of a Floridian retirement center in the year 2060, we won't lean over to each other and say, "You remember that time we didn't eat pig anus?"
Eating something exotic gives you an opportunity to make a personal connection. When you're on a first date and your potential bae suggests the sushi boat for two, you don't want to be the person who says, "I don't like sushi." You also don't want to be the person who says, "I don't like boats," which would just be strange. You want to be the person who boards the sushi boat and says, "Ahoy, matey," and sails it right into a committed and healthy long-term relationship.
Eating crazy foods can save your life. What happens if you accidentally touch a poisonous frog while studying abroad in Venezuela, and a local shaman insists that you ingest a foul-tasting magic elixir in order to survive? Turning it down because you don't like the taste or the texture of foul-tasting magic elixir could result in your death. Not cool.
Finally, pickiness isn't great for the apocalypse. At any moment, our world could become a Mad Max-like desert landscape filled with leather-clad guitarists strapped to rusted-out school buses. If you're lucky enough to stumble upon a dead pig during those dark times, and all that's left is the anus, you get the picture. Our process for eating something nasty.
Once you've determined that you're going to eat something that falls outside the tasty zone and is truly nasty, you can't just start eating it. No. If you don't have a process, you're very likely to end up ralphing that chicken heart right into your custom barf bucket. We've by no means perfected it, but we have developed a detailed process for getting nasty foods to pass through our digestive system without being rejected.
Step 1. Willpower. You must make a definitive decision to eat this nasty thing. There is no room for waffling. This is not a waffle.
Step 2. Self-deception. Convince yourself that you are in a different setting, like a fancy party, where you're trying to fit in with rich people who like to eat gross delicacies like fish eggs, or you have been taken prisoner in a remote jungle by a cannibalistic tribe, and the chief says, "You must eat this pudding made from mud and all the village elders' saliva, or we will eat you." If your reputation or life is at stake, you're gonna eat it.
Step 3. Donkey lipping. We have found that it is helpful to explore a nasty food with your lips prior to eating it, especially when blindfolded. While we've never actually seen a donkey do this with its food, we can assure you that it's a great way to ease into consuming nastiness.
Step 4. Smell inhibition. Some 80% of taste is smell, so you can remove most of the nastiness of food if you disengage your nose. This is the one case where being a mouth breather is not only acceptable, but of great benefit.
Step 5. Chipmunking. Once you have gotten the nasty food into your mouth, there is no better way to induce instant gagging than going for an early swallow. Instead, place the undesirable chow in your cheek, slowly working out small amounts to chew and swallow. By the way, we have seen chipmunks do this.
Step 6. Self-flagellation. The most difficult stage is swallowing. We have found it useful, well, I have, to beat our chest like gorillas and yell in order to convince our bodies to swallow particularly nasty food. This is not recommended in restaurant settings.
Step 7. Chaser. Swallowing the food doesn't mean you're out of the woods. Millions of years of survival adaptations have attuned your body to vomit up unfamiliar, foul food. Following up with a familiar food or liquid can convince your stomach to hold on.
And step 8, the great escape. You want the nasty food to exit your body like you would leave a community theater play, quickly and quietly. Don't tax your body with more unwelcome foods until you have passed this one nasty thing into the abyss. The abyss is the toilet, in case you aren't following. Willet Pioneers.
We have a long-standing tradition on GMM of asking the question, will it? In which we attempt to combine two foods that have likely never been brought together before. Of course, we weren't the first to do this. In fact, some of history's most loved foods are a result of brave people stepping out and asking, will it?
Will it sandwich? Julia David Chandler. Peanut butter and jelly sandwich. In 1901, Miss Chandler published the first recipe for PB&J in the unnecessarily formal-sounding publication, The Boston Cooking School Magazine of Culinary Science and Domestic Economics. She wrote, "For variety, try making little sandwiches, or bread fingers, of 3 very thin layers of bread and 2 of filling, 1 of peanut paste, whatever brand you prefer, and currant or crab apple jelly for the other. The combination is delicious and, so far as I know, original. Bravo, Julia David Chandler! Also, how come nobody eats crab apple jelly anymore?"
Will it breakfast? Tia Sophia's restaurant, The Breakfast Burrito. Folks in New Mexico had been eating eggs and bacon wrapped in tortillas long before the owners of Tia Sophia's branded theirs as a breakfast burrito in 1975. However, sometimes that little extra bit of branding is what allows a great idea to grow wings and become a handful of happiness for boys and girls around the world.
Will it dessert? Frank Wisner, the root beer float. One night in 1893, Frank Wisner was gazing out his window in Cripple Creek, Colorado, and was so taken by the view of the snow on nearby Cow Mountain that he decided to recreate the scene in his drink by dropping a scoop of ice cream into his root beer. Thus, the root beer float was born in the most romantic Willet way possible. Side note, the root beer float was originally called a Black Cow Mountain, later shortened to Black Cow by the Cripple Creek children, and later changed to root beer float so people wouldn't think it had a cow in it.
Willet late night? Gino Paolucci, the pizza roll. The king of frozen food got his start packaging Chinese food for grocery store mass consumption in the 1950s. In true Willet pioneer spirit, however, Gino's legacy stems from an experiment that fused his Italian heritage with the machine that made his egg rolls. The result was the legendary pizza roll, the late-night snack and sleepover staple for generations to come. Sadly, when Gino sold his company to Pillsbury, they rebranded his product as Totino's. but he still lives on in every pizza roll. To clarify, he is not actually inside any pizza rolls.
Will it ethically questionable snack? Rob Nelson, Big League Chew. When Rob Nelson was nearing the end of his baseball playing career at the dawn of the 80s, he met a kid who liked to pretend he was a big league ball player by chewing on black licorice and then spitting out the dark juice. Nelson thought it would be a great idea to apply the same principle to bubble gum, and, long story short, he invented Big League Chew, the gum that made every baseball and softball player swell with the confidence of a big league chewing tobacco addict. It would be tough to adequately explain just how cool Big League Chew was in the late 80s and early 90s. Somewhere, the inventor of candy cigarettes is crying into three fingers of scotch, wondering where they went wrong.
Willett Willett? William Willett Jr. We would be remiss if we wrote a section about Willett pioneers and didn't include someone from the Willett whiskey family, a mainstay in Bardstown, Kentucky for hundreds of years. We picked William Jr., born in 1743, because the Willett family website says that he operated an ordinary, which was a tavern that doubled as an all-inclusive inn for travelers and their horses. William would be saddened to learn that hotels no longer allow horses, but he can't learn because he's dead. Chapter 8.
Unleash a signature dance move.
A lot of people experience a sudden anxiety when they learn that an event they are attending may involve dancing. For them, the thought of attempting to gyrate their midsection or move their limbs to music in a semi-recognizable pattern is a straight-up nightmare. We're convinced that they're just thinking about it all wrong. Dancing remains one of the purest forms of self-expression, and that makes it a unique opportunity to be mythical.
In seventh grade, the powers that be at Buies Creek School announced that we would be having a lip-sync contest at that year's seventh and eighth grade dance. Link and I were both obsessed with DJ Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince, a.k.a. Will Smith, having memorized every word of all their songs, so we knew we would be performing one of their tracks. It may not strike you as terribly strategic for two guys to lip-sync a song from a group consisting of one DJ and one rapper, seeing as how only one guy is doing something you can actually sync your lips to, but Link had a plan. While their latest album, And In This Corner, had plenty of songs to choose from, including the popular single, I Think I Can Beat Mike Tyson, Link convinced me that we should perform Jazzy's Groove, a song featuring Will rapping his best friend's praises. Sure, there were a couple of small speaking parts for Jeff, but there were also long periods of uninterrupted record scratching. Why limit ourselves to lip-syncing when we could incorporate scratch-syncing? Link argued. I reluctantly agreed. I would rap as the Fresh Prince, and Link would man a fake cardboard box DJ booth, bringing the record-spinning heat as DJ Jazzy Jeff himself.
I could tell that Rhett had his doubts about my plan. The contest would be judged by the level of applause from our peers, much like our favorite TV talent show at the time, Showtime at the Apollo. Our reputations were on the line, and for some reason, he worried about my ability to capture the crowd by just rubbing my hands on top of a 3-foot-tall box.
The song began. The rap kicked in, and judging by the looks on the acne-laden faces staring at me, I was off to a strong start. I had practiced hard and hit each word perfectly, spitting out lines like, "Jeff's about to give an incredible display and unequivocally prove that he's the best DJ." But with those lyrics, I was really setting the bar high for Link and his box. Then, the first record-scratching break came. I turned to Link, who gave me a reassuring nod, then looked down and went to work. As he caressed the cardboard in time with the music, I surveyed the crowd. It was obvious that this was not going to hold up. He was losing the audience fast, but Link was so engrossed in his box, he had no idea that it wasn't working. That's when I began to dance. Unfortunately, I had planned absolutely no dance moves, so I winged it. I began with a very basic version of the Running Man, and then checked the crowd. We still had at least 10 seconds before I would begin rapping again, and they seemed to be thinking, okay, yeah, he's doing the Running Man, big deal. And so, without any forethought or calculation, I amended the Running Man on the spot, adding an outward leg kick. Some eyebrows raised, and we had the crowd on our side again. The rapping picked up once more, and I hit every lyric without missing a beat. Of course, I knew that Mr. Box Scratcher was soon due for another round, so I entered the next DJ break completely ready. I reintroduced my modified running man, this time trying my outward leg kick in both directions and even throwing in a complete 360-degree turn. Everybody was into it.
It was at this point that I, head down in the middle of another perfect depiction of the complex finger stylings of the world's best DJ, heard the crowd react with clapping and a few shouts of woot. I knew it. My plan had worked. These sheltered middle schoolers had never seen anyone execute box top record scratching at this level. To soak in the admiration, I looked up. There he was, my gangly best friend, kicking his legs in all directions, spinning like an ice skater who had been injected with adrenaline. I had no idea what he was doing, but it was working. We were gonna win this thing. Even though Rhett's weird dance was taking the pressure off of me, I still continued my amazing DJ pantomiming to the very end.
When the song ended, everyone cheered, just as loudly as they did for our classmate Linwood Campbell after he performed The Choice Is Yours by Black Sheep. We tied, but it was still a huge victory. I left the dance that night with a newfound confidence in my ability to invent a completely original dance out of nowhere.
My personal peak in original dance creation occurred in college at a 70s-themed party. These parties were incredibly popular at colleges in the late 90s because you could still easily go to a thrift store and score a pair of bell-bottoms and a shirt with a butterfly collar. A number of partygoers were dancing, most of them doing some lame version of the repeated disco point, which is often what people default to during 70s music. No one was really making a statement. This was my chance. I approached the DJ, who was actually just a dude at the CD player who didn't want to dance, placed my hand on his shoulder and said, "Give me some Brick House." If you happen to not be familiar with the funky masterpiece that is the Commodore's Brick House, I feel sorry for you. All you need to know, though, is that it's a song celebrating the fullness of a woman's body, going so far as to compare it to an actual structure made of bricks, the only structure that the big bad wolf couldn't blow down. Drummer Walter Clyde Orange's lead vocals paint a poetic picture with lines such as, "The lady's stacked, and that's a fact. Ain't holding nothing back." In other words, it's the perfect song for a 145-pound male college student in extremely tight pants to get down to. I walked to the middle of the dance floor and thought to myself, I'm going to give these people something completely original. As the music started, I gave myself over to the rhythm as if I were being puppeteered by the drums and bass. I was bending, bouncing, and wiggling in ways I didn't think my body could handle. Halfway through the song, everyone else just stopped dancing. They got out of my way and watched me explore the far reaches of musical body movement. I eventually settled into a dance in which I pictured a gate in front of me, the kind you'd see at the exit of a parking garage. I would take a step over this imaginary gate, duck back under it, then proceed with a brisk pelvic thrust. It was more than a dance. It felt like an out-of-body experience. When the music was over, a girl approached me and asked, "What was that?" I responded with, "Oh, that? Just a little something." I had unleashed a signature dance move.
We've never really been fans of predetermined dances. We resist falling into a conga line, and we've both been known to exit the dance floor if the DJ has the audacity to play the electric slide. Sure, we respect people who have the ability to perfect a specific style of dance, but there's just something more mythical about a dance that is all your own. Improvised dances also have a much easier entry point. You just need to know how to move.
Next time the beat drops and you're presented with an opportunity to dance, don't migrate to the sides of the room. Instead, as the woman from CNC Music Factory, not the woman from the music videos, but the other woman who actually did the singing, sang, "Let the rhythm move you." She also said, "Come on and sweat. Sweat it." You don't necessarily have to sweat, but go out there and take a chance. Here's some things to remember as you unleash your dance.
No one will know if you screw up. Since you're not following a template, there are no mistakes. If you hyperextend your knee in the middle of an especially aggressive pop or lock, causing you to slowly limp off the dance floor, it doesn't matter. It can still be part of your dance. Michael Jackson included tons of zombie limp dancing in Thriller, and it's the greatest music video of all time.
You may end up actually creating a popular dance. Every dance that we now consider a real dance was once just someone's decision to move their body in a certain way. Drake obviously ad-libs his way through all of his music videos, which is why most of his dancing looks like he's brushing some lint off his pants or putting a loaf of bread into a grocery basket. But that hasn't stopped people everywhere from trying to mimic his moves. It's not as hard as you think.
Don't get too locked in. If your dance move is too simple or repetitive, like twirling your hands around in little circles for an entire song, you're going to scare people and lose friends. Mix it up and keep people guessing. Use your arms, legs, neck, don't forget the pelvis. The pelvis is the dancing linchpin. If you pull it out of your dance, the whole thing falls apart.
Just let go and don't look back. Above all, let your dance happen. Don't be afraid to look stupid. Remember that the people standing in the corner watching you dance just wish they could be out there doing what you're doing. You're the one introducing the world to a new mythical dance. How to create and coordinate a show-stopping dance circle.
Up to this point, this chapter has been all about the ways that you can own the dance floor as a performer. However, not everyone will fulfill their destiny as dancers. The ceiling is much higher as a producer or promoter, meaning some folks would be better served to essentially take over the dance floor by orchestrating the atmosphere. For those of you who possess the rare combination of a puppet master's personality and limited rhythm, we would like to offer up the 5 steps to producing a perfect dance circle.
Step 1. Target a track. A great dance circle starts with a great song. For years, Michael Jackson's Billie Jean was an automatic circle starter. There's a clear reason for this. The best dance circle songs have more than 100 beats per minute and almost always contain obscure lyrics that are difficult to understand. In Billie Jean, Michael says, "Who will dance on the floor in the round?" or something very much like that. Unclear lyrics help the audience to focus on the dancing. Find a modern song that you don't quite understand the meaning of with a tempo of over 100 BPM and you'll be in business.
Step 2. Circle the wagons. When your track gets dropped, find a great dancer on the floor and begin to circle him or her rapidly, protecting your star from the crowd like you're the Secret Service at a presidential meet and greet.
Step 3. Make them believe the hype. As you establish your perimeter, begin to bring special attention to your first dancer. It can be helpful to shout something like, "Go Janet, go Janet, go, go, go Janet," especially if your dancer's name is Janet. Make the crowd want Janet to go.
Step 4. Scout the perimeter. Keep an eye out for your next dancer. Your first dancer is always an alpha dancer, but to keep the crowd guessing, your next entry should be a diamond in the rough, someone unexpected who looks to possess more flavor than he or she lets on in his or her daily life.
And step 5. Give them the hook. Most dance circles end early because they grow stale and predictable. 2 or 3 dancers, addicted to the momentary love of the crowd, keep jumping back into the circle, and, given that they use their best moves in their first appearance, they quickly underperform. For this reason, you must curate your circle by pulling dancers out after no more than 30 seconds. It's your job to make sure that there are new flavors constantly being added to the mix. Chapter 9.
Get your hands dirty.
Growing up in rural North Carolina, we were taught the value of a good, firm handshake. To achieve one, you need to first establish a properly set grip. Getting that webbing between your thumb and index finger, we like to call it the hand crotch, in full contact with the same area of the other shaker's hand. Hand crotch to hand crotch contact is essential. Also, you must look the other person in the eyes the entire time. People who break eye contact mid-shake can't be trusted. They are the kinds of people who are definitely hiding something, like a collection of weird, faceless dolls in their attic. If you want to be respected, you give a confident handshake.
Besides the grip and eyes, there remains an additional piece of data you can gather from a handshake, the softness of the hands. While this is something that people have much less control over, you can still draw some important conclusions from it. In Buies Creek, We would often shake a hand with thick, muscle-bound fingers covered in skin that felt like a pair of alligator boots. It was obvious that this was the hand of a working man, someone who made a living by the sweat of his brow.
Living in Los Angeles, it's easy to go for years without shaking a hand like that, because this is a town full of people making their living not with their hands, but with their faces and mouths. If and when the long-anticipated massive earthquake hits Southern California, this city of pretty-faced, soft-handed people won't stand a chance.
Of course, we're talking as if this doesn't apply to us, but our hands are just as soft as a voiceover artist lounging poolside in Palm Springs. At this point, our manual labor consists mostly of mounting abstract oil paintings with names like Translucent Eggs Number 7 to the walls of our houses in locations our wives have approved. We don't even mow our own grass. It's pathetic, we know. Thankfully, before we became softies who get paid to flap our pie holes, we each had the chance to learn what real work was.
Seeing as how we grew up literally surrounded by tobacco fields, it was nearly unavoidable that at least one of us would end up falling into the gravitational pull of North Carolina's economic epicenter. Three of my Nana's unibrowed brothers were tobacco farmers, and each summer they needed seasonal help to process their crop. During the summer of 1994, I had just turned 16, and I was enjoying the newfound freedom afforded by my driver's license. I'd gladly accept any excuse to drive anywhere, even to work. When my Uncle Johnny offered me a job on the farm, I pictured myself zooming down all those back roads, a hard-working man, with my tanned elbow hanging out of the driver's side window of my red 1987 Nissan pickup, featuring chrome wheels and a Brooks & Dunn front plate. The scene looked epic. I accepted the job. I learned that I'd be barning tobacco, which sounded easy enough, but I failed to account for several factors. First and foremost was the crippling heat. Even though we started each day at dawn in order to minimize our time in the blistering North Carolina summer sun, our clothes were soaked through with sweat less than an hour after we started. If you've never spent much time outdoors in the southern United States during the summer months, just imagine what it would be like to constantly be in a bathroom with a hot shower running. Everyone walks around with a shiny film of perspiration on their faces, like they're all auditioning for a role alongside Matthew McConaughey in an Old South period piece. It adds a grueling element to any outdoor activity. My job was to stack tobacco into a large metal rack and then help guide the full racks into a metal barn. It was really more of a box, where the tobacco would dry into its familiar brown and brittle state. That was it. Over and over and over again. It was the most monotonous job I'd ever had, and the repetition of stacking and stowing tobacco lulled me into a semi-conscious state. I would end up standing there motionless for minutes at a time, neglecting my simple duties. My Uncle Johnny would say, "He's having another brain fart." I would snap back into the moment, grab the rack, and do my part. A few more minutes would pass, and I would fall right back into my state of cranial flatulence. That summer, I earned the nickname Mr. Brain Fart, and it was well deserved. Barning was far from the worst part of the job, however. One day, the majority of the tobacco that we were handling was wet from an overnight rain. Later that afternoon, I began to feel ill. The next morning, I woke up feeling even worse. It turns out that my skin had absorbed the nicotine from the wet tobacco, and I was suffering from a condition called green tobacco sickness. It was absolutely awful. When I wasn't lying in bed with a splitting headache, I was in the bathroom playing eeny, meeny, miny, mo between orifices. I decided that this would be my last summer of working tobacco. I had done my required part as a North Carolina native, contributing to the distribution of more cigarettes around the world.
I, too, was given a chance to temporarily try my hand at callus-inducing work before I eventually settled into my cushy entertainment job. Frankie Hamilton, the father of one of our close friends, Trent, owned a residential real estate construction company. The same summer that Link was toiling in tobacco, Trent was planning to work for his dad and asked me if I wanted to join him. This seemed like the sweetest deal possible. I knew Trent well enough to guess that he wasn't going to needlessly overexert himself for the family business. Furthermore, his dad was well regarded as a wealthy man, so it naturally followed that I was going to be raking in cash like a 16-year-old Scrooge McDuck. The reality of my circumstances came crashing down on me when Frankie informed me that I would be making just $6 an hour, and I would not be working alongside Trent. He had set aside a very important job for me. I would be the sole individual responsible for cleaning out the crawl spaces of newly constructed homes. I remember kneeling down and peering into my first crawl space, completely unaware of what horrors were lurking in the blackness. I folded up my 6-foot-5-inch frame, I had not yet reached my wholly unnecessary height of 6-foot-7, and crawled on my belly, a flashlight in one hand and a trash bag in the other. I quickly learned that construction workers viewed the open foundation of a home as a veritable dumpster and occasional toilet until it was covered with subflooring. Every few feet or so, I would discover a new surprise. It might be a crumpled-up Big Mac carton covered in ants enjoying special sauce remnants, or if I was lucky, it was an RC Cola bottle half full of what looked to be RC Cola, but was actually dark, putrid tobacco spit. It was lovely. In order to make it through that first day, I pretended that I was an archaeologist excavating an important Mayan ruin, seeking to discover clues about an ancient people. However, it was hard to maintain that illusion each time I crawled through a section of dirt that reeked of construction worker urine. It has its own distinct scent, bush light and pressure-treated lumber. That summer, I would return home each evening to nurse another knot on my head and hop in the shower to release a cavalcade of dust boogers that had accumulated in my nostrils. The following summer, Frankie promised me the opportunity to explore a more legitimately constructive part of the construction business. With a completely straight face, he informed me and Trent that he wanted us to build a house. Given that I had barely ever swung a hammer, I figured he either had a stroke or was talking about a doghouse. But no, he wanted us to frame an actual home that a human family would later occupy. He said, "Mr. Fred will help y'all." Mr. Fred was a 65-year-old retired friend of Frankie's who helped out with various jobs in order to stay not actually retired. Every day he wore a blue short-sleeve shirt that said Fred on it and smoked at least one pack of cigarettes. I was really hoping he knew how to construct a home. Thankfully, some qualified people had laid the foundation, floor joists, and subflooring, so our job was limited to framing the house. On the first day, Mr. Fred lit a cigarette and said, "Let me show you how to build a wall." Before he finished his cigarette, he had deftly nailed together a series of 8-foot-long 2x4s, 16 inches on center. He then asked us to stand the wall up on some marks he made on the subfloor and proceeded to quickly nail the wall into place. He commanded, "Let go." The wall stood there on its own. This was going to be a breeze. "Now y'all do it." Mr. Fred lit another cigarette and walked off into the yard and sat down under a tree. Approximately 1 hour later, our wall was complete, but still lying on its side, waiting to be set up right and nailed into place. Mr. Fred moseyed on over, tossed aside another expended cigarette, stepped up onto the foundation, and said flatly, "Took you long enough." He then leaned in to inspect our work. He pointed at one of the many nails sticking out from our wall, making it look like a strange cactus, the result of our nail gun ineptitude. "Don't do that," he said. He then ordered, "Okay, stand her up." Trent and I reached down to proudly see our work materialize as an actual wall, but when we lifted, it wouldn't budge. Mr. Fred shook his head and said, "Y'all nailed the damn thing to the floor." He then lit another cigarette and went back to his tree, leaving me and Trent to solve the problem ourselves. After a few weeks of being forced to deal with our own blunders, Trent and I were semi-respectable home builders. Sure, we continued to make mistakes, like the time we misread the blueprints and accidentally made one of the bedroom closets a mere 12 inches deep. But we pulled it off. We framed an entire house. Every time I think about some poor soul in Western Harnett County having to hang their shirts sideways in their ridiculously shallow closet, I feel a sense of pride knowing that I can build a house. Sort of. I'm grateful that Frankie asked us to do something so far above our capabilities that summer. I think he wanted his son to get a small taste of manual labor, knowing that a couple of summers on a construction site would be enough to motivate him to get a college degree and not have to make a living by the sweat of his brow. It worked. But there was more to it than that.
Getting our hands dirty, even if it was only for a few short summers in high school, has helped us approach our current jobs with more curiosity and appreciation. Those hot summers remind us how lucky we are to do what we do today. When we happen to get our hands dirty these days, it's not because we're handling tobacco or hammering a nail. It's usually because we're doing something like dipping our hands in honey, nuts, and Cheerios, and then interlocking our fingers and putting our fist into a bowl of milk so we can enjoy Honey Nut Cheerio Hand Cereal. We may work hard, but it's not hard work. Without those summer jobs, we might not have that perspective.
Plus, we actually learned some useful skills during those summers. We hope that tobacco barning knowledge won't be necessary at any point in the future, but when that earthquake hits and all the soft-handed people's homes collapse, I may actually be able to help rebuild the city of Los Angeles, as long as everyone is okay living in two-bedroom ranch-style homes with one extremely shallow closet.
Our short stints at real jobs also serve as a reminder that there are millions of individuals out there roughening up their hands and breaking their backs every day. We wouldn't have our houses or cigarettes without them. It's enough to make us want to listen to the song from the classic country group Alabama called 40 Hour Week for a Living. Do yourself a favor and Google it, and then watch the music video. It features every member of the band portraying a blue-collar worker, as well as some out-of-place dance numbers. In fact, you could have just listened to that song instead of listening to this chapter. But it's too late now.
My Worst Summer Job by The Mythical Crew.
Like us, most members of the Mythical Crew have worked at least one terrible yet character-building summer job. Here are their descriptions of those minimum wage experiences, along with what each crummy job taught them.
Jen, I delivered newspapers every Wednesday and Friday, but I was no ordinary paper girl. I didn't ride a bike. I rode on rollerblades. The worst part was that when it would rain, driveways would get very slippery. I crawled up and down many driveways to stuff a sopping wet newspaper into someone's mailbox for $2.50 an hour. The job definitely taught me accountability. I knew I had to make it up those driveways because people were counting on me and my killer rollerblades for their local news.
Eddie, I was a stock associate at Old Navy. I'd get up at 5 a.m., ride my bike to the mall, and unload boxes and boxes of performance fleece and $1 flip-flops for 4 hours. Then, for the next 4 hours, I'd stand next to the fitting room to make sure people went in and came out with the same number of khakis. To make things fun during breaks, my manager would put on a DVD of season 2 of Friends to keep morale up. I hate Friends. Chandler's voice literally began haunting my dreams. So I quit. I learned that a job isn't going to be cool just because your title has the word associate in it.
Casey. When I was 14, I operated the Dragon Train at Heritage Square Amusement Park. I had to clean up a lot of kid vomit. I never understood it. It was a slow train on a circle track. Sure, it was shaped like a dragon, but come on. I learned that great bonds can be made over crappy jobs and that well-made amusement park rides have vomit drain holes.
Lizzie, I worked for a cash for gold company that collects human teeth from dentists and sells them for their precious metals. This is a real thing. I met a woman in a parking deck and rifled through a bucket of teeth in the trunk of her Mercedes. I quit later that week. I am thrilled to be alive. I learned you should trust your gut. If something seems shady, it probably is, and if you find yourself buying teeth in the alley behind a Yoshinoya, it definitely is.
Stevie, I worked at Build-A-Bear from 16 through my freshman year of college. I had to endure a lot of kid slobber, but the worst part was when the adult couples would come in to make a bear. There's a part in the process where you hand a little cloth heart to the bear maker and ask them to make a wish and kiss the heart before sticking it inside the bear. For some reason, every couple saw this as their opportunity to say something totally inappropriate and then proceed to make out less than a foot away from me. Adult slobber. The worst. I learned to stop offering adult couples the little cloth heart.
Morgan. I performed general maintenance at a summer camp. Turns out general maintenance includes daily cleaning of the outhouses and emptying the rotting kitchen trash that was stored in an airtight outdoor shed. It was a long summer. I learned that you should get specific details before accepting a job with general in the title.
Alex. My summer after graduating college, I got a job as a grader for elementary school standardized math tests. Each week, we were given only one question that we would have to evaluate for thousands of different kids over and over. And I despise math. I did learn some math, though.
Kevin, one summer I worked at a print shop where I made copies of blueprints alongside two 80-year-old women who chain-smoked all day long. $8 an hour was meager compensation for all those paper cuts and secondhand smoke, but there was an amazing Carl's Jr. across the street. I learned how to make copies of blueprints. Haven't copied a blueprint since, but if the day ever comes, I'll be prepared.
Chapter 10.
Say I love you like it's never been said.
In this chapter, we'll be talking about the efforts we undertook to convince our wives to marry us. While using terms like our wives and marry us might seem to suggest that we are in some kind of two-man, two-woman, polygamous arrangement, known as the squarriage in some circles, that is not the case. It is just an unfortunate byproduct of using the collective we voice to talk about our marriages. We will begin speaking individually about our wives soon, and hopefully it will clear up any confusion. In the meantime, we will use the term wives to refer to our wives. It's incorrect English, but it helps to establish that we are speaking jointly about two distinct individuals. If you don't like it, you're free to mark out the F and replace it with a V, although it will lower the value of this book by 7%.
Early on in our career, we made the decision to limit how often we put our families on camera. Sure, we used our kids if we needed a baby for something. Both Link's daughter Lily and my son Locke were in our first internet video, Pimp My Stroller, and we once used all of them as weights in a video called Kid Dumbbells. But it has not been a regular thing. Our wives, Jessie, mine, and Christy, Link's, never expressed a desire to be in the spotlight. And we learned early on just how heartless a place the YouTube comment section could be, especially toward women. So we saw very little reason to parade them in front of our audience. As a result, our wives have remained somewhat shrouded in mystery, until now.
We've decided to pull the curtain back a bit in order to talk about romance because we think it's possible to fall in love in a mythical way. While we personally think we did some pretty mythical things during the process of wooing our wives, we're not the best ones to judge that. So, we have asked Jessie and Christy to contribute their perspectives throughout this chapter in order for you to know the truth. This may have been a bad idea, and it could go horribly wrong for us. But here we go.
Even though Jessie's father was my dentist growing up, I had no idea she existed. It wasn't until my junior year in college during a trip back home that I met her. From our very first conversation, I was mesmerized. She was unlike any girl I'd ever met. Sure, she wasn't the only girl in North Carolina who was funny, intelligent, talented, and beautiful, but I felt an instant, intense connection with her. It was like we had been preparing to meet our entire lives, only to be perfectly in sync when we finally did. Then she told me she was a senior in high school. What the? Mission compromised! Abort! Abort! Screamed a voice in my head. Despite my connection with her, I was not about to date a high schooler. So I didn't. Kind of.
If your definition of not dating includes asking a girl to go to concerts, restaurants, and on hikes with you, calling her at 11 p.m. the night before Valentine's Day to see if she wants to go to a Valentine's banquet together, and doing everything in your power to make her like you, except opening doors for her that would cross the line, then yes, we were not dating. The good thing about not dating Rhett, though, was that I could freely not date other guys as well, which I did. But he had my heart, and I couldn't get that tall, almost scarily skinny boy out of my head. When I was with him, the world came alive. He once created a whole brochure about the New Zealand holiday, Waitangi Day. We happened to be going out on one of our non-dates that night, and he thought we should commemorate the day with pizza, coffee, and a stroll through the aisles of Super Kmart. It was a small town in a simpler time. He was both utterly silly and staggeringly smart, which is a pretty dynamic combo. After hanging out with him one night, I floated into my house and reported to my mom, "He's a beautiful person." She had never heard me talk about a boy like this before.
The first time I saw Christy, she was standing in line waiting for the roller rink to open. I remember she was making all her friends laugh. Plus, she was gorgeous. I had to meet her. When you're in third grade, a great way to tell a girl you think she's the one is to intentionally trip her while she's roller skating. So that's what I did. Except I wasn't in third grade. I was a sophomore in college.
It was a college social. I remember arriving early at Jelly Bean's Super Skate Center because of how nervous I was that I couldn't actually skate. I was wearing my usual preppy style outfit, a white collar button up with an orange J. Crew sweater neatly tied over my shoulders, and pearl earrings. I noticed a guy with bleach blonde spiked hair and huge, wide leg jeans making his way down the line. He definitely wasn't my type. But when he looked at me and I got one glimpse of his eyes, I knew a conversation needed to be started immediately. I said something about how anxious I was about skating for the first time. He offered to give me lessons, and he assured me that they would be successful. Then he walked back to the end of the line. After a couple of songs, Link found me in the rink, and we started the lessons. He would skate up and offer some quick advice, skate off, and then return a few minutes later to check on me. Only later did I learn that there were two other girls that he was checking on as well. And then, in the middle of one of those checkups, Link thought it would be funny to insert his wheels into my wheels to make me fall, which I did. But as he was making his quick getaway, I grabbed the cuff of his wide leg jeans and pulled him down with me. Of the three girls getting skating lessons that night, I won.
Jessie spent the summer before her freshman year in college as a camp counselor in the mountains of North Carolina, while I was in Eastern Europe working at an English teaching camp. In order to lay the foundation for an actual romantic relationship in the fall, I developed a complex plan of correspondence. In the late 90s, it wasn't unusual for people to get their first email address when they entered college, so Jessie didn't have an account. However, her 75-year-old grandmother, whom we called Gaga, did. AOL, of course. Throughout that summer, I would find an internet cafe in whatever town I found myself in and write Gaga an email. The first paragraph would be addressed to Gaga. Then I would write, "Okay, Gaga, this next part is for Jessie." Gaga would then print the email out and snail mail it to Jessie in the mountains. Jessie would handwrite a letter in response and mail it to me in Europe. This was our correspondence for the summer of 1999. It was like those letters from Ken Burns' Civil War documentary, just without the war.
Let me just say that camp counseling, while it may not be hand-to-hand combat, is no walk in the park. I was dealing with a cabin full of prepubescent girls, and I'm not sure I was fully equipped to handle all of their shenanigans. Getting a letter from Rhett via my Gaga was surprising, magical, and comforting. He was on a completely different continent, and yet still found a way to connect with me in the rural mountains of North Carolina. And he was winning me over.
Christy attended Meredith College, a private women's school that was basically across the street from my school, NC State. Meredith was surrounded by towering walls topped with ominous wrought iron demons and a deep moat filled with the blood of fallen suitors. Okay, there were no demons and no blood in the moats, or moats at all. But Meredith did have walls and a gate with a guard on duty all night. I took it as a challenge and an opportunity to prove my love for Christy on Valentine's Day.
At this point, we had officially been dating for a little over a year. Back on our first Valentine's date, Link brought me a lovely peach white-tipped rose and took me out to lunch. I don't remember very much about that lunch date, but I did have another Valentine's date that night with a guy named Andrew. I do remember that date. It was great.
If you're going to take someone out for Valentine's Day, do not make it a lunch date. You're just inviting someone else to swoop in for dinner. So, 1 year later, things were getting more serious, and I wanted to make my Valentine's Day mythical. Lionel Richie's Stuck on You was our song, so I asked myself, what would Lionel do? Then I went to CVS Pharmacy and bought a couple of hundred square yellow post-it notes. I scaled the wall of Meredith just before daybreak. Then I climbed on the hood of her car and started posting. I'd spent the previous hour meticulously cutting each note into the shape of a heart. Now I was just desperately hoping no one else drove a 1989 blue Honda Accord with a dream catcher hanging from the mirror. I arranged the notes in a huge, heart-shaped configuration, wrote a note on the last one, and then disappeared into the night. Take that, Andrew.
That morning, I walked out to the parking lot to head to work and found my car covered in heart-shaped post-it notes. One said, "I'm stuck on you." It was so creative and sweet. I was late to work because it took a while to pull them all off, but I didn't mind at all. In fact, I've kept those hearts for over 17 years. I also still have my sticker collection from third grade. It's a very special sticker collection.
Once Jessie was on campus that fall, my efforts to convince her to be my girlfriend went into full effect. It was time for our first official date, and I considered the details carefully. I wanted to communicate that I was a man of means with impeccable taste in restaurants, so I took her to Outback Steakhouse. As far as I was concerned, Outback was a top-tier restaurant. They served prime cuts of meat and had a signature appetizer, and the servers wore collared shirts with cool pins all over them. In my 20-year-old mind, Outback said, "I'm serious about the potential of this relationship, and I think the Australians really know how to cook meat."
I remember the pink shirt and black capris that I wore that night because it was a big deal. He had sent me an actual invitation in the mail to go out with him on an official date with yes and no boxes to check. In an unprecedented move, he even went so far as to open the car door for me. But he didn't simply walk around to his side of the car and get in. He grabbed a random pair of enormous aviator sunglasses that were left over in his car from some discarded costume and began to do an impression of a police officer, questioning me in a flirty way. I laughed at first because it was funny, but then he kept going, and I started to sweat a little. I had no idea how to respond. He was actually unabashedly flirting with me for the first time, but he was pretending to be a police officer while doing it. I couldn't decide if it was really charming or really creepy, and those aviators fell firmly outside the proper sunglasses-to-head ratio. But I had to give him one thing. He had guts.
Christy and I spent the summer after our junior year of college on opposite coasts. She was in Santa Cruz, California, and I was taking summer classes in Raleigh. But I wanted to develop a strategy to keep us connected. I called it the Lincoln Christie Long Distance Walkie-Talkie, or the LCLDWT if you're into unpronounceable acronyms. Since actual long-distance walkie-talkies, that is, cell phones, weren't widely used yet, I utilized advanced mixtape technology, that is, cassettes. Think of it as an audio-only vlog made on a handheld cassette recorder. I'd carry it in my pocket and capture snippets of my day, interject my thoughts and commentary for Christy, and of course, throw in some Lionel Richie. Then I'd mail it across the continent. She'd add on to the same tape and then mail it back to me. Since we only spoke on the phone around once a week, getting that tape in the mail was really a thrill.
I loved Link's idea of the LCLDWT. He recorded the first installment for my flight to California. This was a big deal because it was my first time ever on a plane. Yep, I was a junior in college and I'd never been on an airplane. But hey, at least I could roller skate by this point. I pressed play as the plane was taxiing the runway, and Link guided me through the process of takeoff. He probably kept me from having a panic attack that morning. It was seriously the sweetest thing, and all of the passengers around me enjoyed it too. I didn't have headphones, so I took a risk and played it for everyone to listen in. We shared our summers with each other on that tape. I would sit on the beach, press record, and just tell him about my day. I couldn't wait to mail it off after adding my installment, because he literally couldn't add to the conversation until he received the tape. And when he mailed it back to me, I would run to the beach to listen to what he had recorded. No longer with strangers listening in.
It didn't take me long to realize that I wanted to spend the rest of my life with Jessie. Of course, she was a college freshman with her whole life ahead of her, and she had the ability to date whomever she pleased. I had to up my game and prove that I was worth committing to, so I decided to get creative. Over the course of that year, I dug deep into the depths of my personal reservoir of mythicality, unleashing a series of tactics to communicate just how hard I was falling for Jessie.
And communicate he did. We talked on the phone, sure, but this was in the days of yore, when phones were connected to walls and texting wasn't a thing. I got lots of emails with lots of words, and words are my favorite. Red also continued to work that snail mail. He sent me a fake letter from a fake teacher in the music, my major department, complete with the official letterhead. He sent me an article about myself written by Harry D. Reporta. He wrote a heartwarming fairy tale that had an uncanny resemblance to our relationship. He also really loved the free clip art you could add to your Word documents to spice them up. Let's just say I have received lots of typed letters with dogs holding a sign with my name on it and teddy bears hugging hearts. They were the emojis of the 90s.
By the following summer, things were getting very serious. Jessie was going to Los Angeles for a couple of months to work with the homeless and inner-city youth, and I selfishly wanted to make sure she kept thinking about me. There was no video chat, and I didn't want to distract her from her work by calling her constantly, so I made a doll of myself, kind of like a flat Stanley, and gave it to her before she left.
Genius move. Since Rhett couldn't be there in person, he sent a surrogate. I would carry baby Rhett around with me, which must have acted as a huge deterrent to any other dudes who might have been interested. They would see that either A, I was taken, or B, I was a weirdo who carried a homemade doll around with her.
Even though Jesse's parents' dog ate the Rhett doll shortly after she returned home, my plan to remain on her mind and in her heart worked. At least it seemed to, because when I asked her to marry me a week after she got back, she said yes. And while the fact that I proposed to her while she was only 19 years old seems completely insane to me now, it was. We don't recommend getting engaged as a teenager. We are extremely fortunate that it has worked out well for us, and that we've been happily married for 16 years.
Did Rhett mention that you shouldn't get engaged at 19?
A week before Christy came home from her summer in Santa Cruz, I went to visit her parents. I called them the night before and casually asked them if they minded if I dropped in. It was a 2-hour detour to drop in on them, and I had never done it before. They knew something was up. I was in the backyard with her dad grilling burgers when I asked for his blessing to marry his daughter. He stared at me, then pointed toward the house. I think you better ask that woman spying on us through the kitchen window. Once I got their blessing, I told them they had to keep it secret for at least a couple of weeks. That's how long it was going to take for me to get the engagement ring. They agreed, and the next morning we all headed to the airport to pick up Christy.
I was so excited to be back at home, to see my parents, my sister, and Link. We drove back to Kinston, my hometown, and the only thing that I missed more than them was Bojangles. After a wonderful reunion with some famous fried chicken and sweet Boberry biscuits, we headed home for the evening. That night, Link and I spent hours outside, walking around my neighborhood, catching up, and talking about our summers. It felt so comfortable to be together again. But then I noticed the vibe shifted a bit. Link got super serious. No laughing, no joking, and he said the three words.
I had this idea at the time, admittedly it was pretty overzealous, that I wasn't going to tell my girlfriend that I loved her until I absolutely knew that I wanted to marry her. I actually explained this to Christy pretty early in our dating relationship. I've always been pretty good at making conversations weird.
I did think it was kind of weird, but when you really like, or even love, someone, you tend to frequently miscategorize kind of weird as kind of cute. So that night in my front yard, I knew what those three words meant. Oh boy, here we go. He's going to propose. So he said he loved me. Then he slowly got down on one knee. There was only one issue. One small, ring-shaped issue. Link didn't have a ring. His proposal turned into an odd run-on sentence. Christy, will you marry me? Even though I don't have a ring, my mom has a friend who runs a jewelry store, and I'm going to get one from her soon. I just need, like, 2 weeks or so. Maybe less. I was supposed to wait to ask you, but I just couldn't. I said yes as soon as he let me get a word in edgewise. I didn't care at all. I was in love. Honestly, I don't believe that you have to have a ring in order to propose to someone, get engaged, or get married. But let's say you are planning to get a ring in 2 weeks or so, then I would highly recommend that you wait until after that point to propose. That's a superior order of operations. Trust me, I know. I have a math degree. And now I also have a diamond ring. It took him a little less than 2 weeks to get it.
As you can see, we made a few missteps as we tried to convince our wives that we were worth committing to. A bloomin' onion is not exactly a wise choice on a first date, and proposals should typically involve rings unless you've both discussed that rings don't matter. Despite our shortcomings, we still made some pretty mythical efforts in those early days when we were trying to show our love.
We're not suggesting that you should follow in our footsteps exactly. In fact, if you decided to do any of the specific things we did, it would actually cancel out the mythicality because they wouldn't be original. When you're deciding what to do to show someone you love them, you don't want it to be something you read in a book or saw in a movie. You want it to be the kind of thing that is so mythical that it should be in a movie. You can't really go wrong. If you go big and it backfires, you'll have a funny story to tell the rest of your life. If it works, you'll have an amazing memory to share with the person you made it with.
A word of caution is necessary, though. Some of the most cringe-worthy videos ever uploaded to the internet feature someone going to great lengths to communicate their love, whether it be asking someone to the prom with a horribly off-key serenade or a marriage proposal involving base jumping into a stadium.